This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Welcome to the Willis Snowmobile Museum in Hopedale, Illinois.
Back in about 78, some farmers out south of town give my oldest boy a snowmobile. Then I thought, well, why would anybody want to be out there riding a snowmobile and working out in that cold?
Yeah, it only takes one. Russell Huck Willis is now up to 150 snowmobiles and counting, and the National Antique Snowmobile Association is coming to Hopedale this weekend. Plus, Adam Kinzinger was a very, very young McLean County board member. Then he was a very young congressman. Now the U.S. representative might be on the way to becoming a U.S. senator. Ryan Denham has more. John Norton has the music of Illinois Rail, and Laura Kennedy brings us the Inside Out Arts Fair. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Congressman Adam Kinzinger is one of Bloomington Normal's most famous political exports, rising from the McLean County Board all the way to Congress. Now, in the Trump era, the Republicans' rising star has become even more visible. GLT's Ryan Denham reports on Kinzinger's path to Congress and what might come next.
20 years ago, Adam Kinzinger was a college kid navigating the politics of the McLean County Board, pushing for fiscal discipline, evening meeting times, and merging the Bloomington Election Commission into the county clerk's office. Now the 41-year-old congressman is everywhere, a regular fixture on cable news and even NPR.
Joining us now, member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois.
He's a member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, and he served in the Air Force, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome.
Thank you.
I just talked to one congressman, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who said that he too would be...
Kinzinger's been considered a rising star since he first entered politics, winning his county board seat at age 20 while still an Illinois State University student. But his national profile has grown considerably in the past year.
One day we're all going to be campaigning for him in the state of Iowa, the state of New Hampshire. He's that good of a messenger, and he's that good of a member of Congress.
That's Congressman Rodney Davis, a fellow House Republican who helped Kinzinger get elected to Congress in 2010.
There's nobody who really espouses the Republican conservative message as well as my friend Adam does.
Kinzinger is a regular on CNN.
So we got to get past that, or we're going to continue in this stupid shutdown idiocy cycle for the rest of our time out here, and that's got to stop.
And MSNBC.
Of ISIS, which there will be an ISIS 2 or an Al-Qaeda 3, because the ideology is not dead, just the organization.
And Fox News.
This is a pattern with Iran. I think the thing we have to keep in mind, Iran has been attacking U.S. interests for 30 years.
The media often turns to Kinzinger on foreign policy and military affairs, given his background. He serves in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, is a veteran himself, and still serves as a lieutenant colonel in the Air National Guard. Pat Brady is the former chair of the Illinois Republican Party. He says Republicans lost one of their top voices on national security and foreign policy when Senator John McCain died last year.
Congressman Kinzinger kind of stepped into that void. They're always looking for someone in the media and others, a leader that knows what he's talking about, to speak when there are big issues, and he seems to have stepped into that role.
Kinzinger's also been more willing to break with President Trump or even criticize him publicly than other House Republicans. Here he is with S.E. Cupp on CNN after Trump said he'd take information that might help his campaign from a foreign government, even though that would be illegal.
Well, look, if you talk to all of them kind of privately, we all agree. Here's the problem.
What good does privately do? I'm so sick of hearing Republicans, when they talk privately, say one thing. What good does that do anyone?
I agree, but here's the issue I'm getting at. So every day there's kind of a new outrage, and about 70% of them aren't any Trump's doing. I think it's stuff taken out of context. When it came to this information, for instance, I took a little bit of time to actually see all this set in context before I made a comment on it. And my comment is, you can't take foreign information from a foreign government. So, look, I wish people would speak out more about stuff like this.
Pat Brady says Kinzinger is a good conservative Republican, but also an independent thinker.
That represents his district well, because I think that's what that district wants. And I think that people expect him to support the president on issues that are consistent with conservative beliefs. But when he steps out of that, those beliefs, or gets out of line, then someone needs to point it out and give Congressman Kinzinger credit. He's had the courage to do that.
Kinzinger's frequent CNN appearances have not gone unnoticed back in his district, according to Kelly Kinate of Fairbury, chair of the Livingston County Republican Party. Generally, he says local Republicans there have a good relationship with Kinzinger and his staff. But Kinzinger's lack of support for Trump during the 26th campaign has not been forgotten.
Now Trump is his commander-in-chief, so being a veteran, I personally see it as, you know, you got to remember your chain of command.
During an interview with WGLT from his office in Washington, Kinzinger says he's just calling balls and strikes.
If there's things that he says I don't like, I'll say that. You know, I'm not looking for an opportunity to go out and disagree with the president, but I'm also going to be honest. And, you know, and I think we need more of that. Frankly, that's what people used to expect of their congressmen, and so that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Those moments of independence aside, Kinzinger still votes in line with Trump's priorities most of the time. The data news site 538 is tracking how members of Congress vote in relationship to Trump's position on specific bills, and Kinzinger has voted with Trump's position 93% of the time. It's about the same as Congressman Rodney Davis and Darren LaHood, the two House Republicans who represent Bloomington-Normal in Congress. Democrat Sarah Dady from Rockford ran against Kinzinger in 2018. He won with 59% of the vote.
What Mr. Kinzinger says and how he votes are often two different things.
Staying in the foreign affairs lane, Kinzinger criticized Trump last year after the president announced a decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, saying ISIS was defeated. But on other issues, Dady says Kinzinger didn't do enough, like condemning the Trump administration's family separation policy at the border.
Mr. Kinzinger is a hawk on military engagement. And so he'll criticize the president when the president isn't as hawkish as Mr. Kinzinger thinks he should be.
Kinzinger doesn't represent Bloomington-Normal anymore, where his political career began on the county board. After first winning a seat in 2010, the redistricting after that year's census bumped him into the 16th congressional district in northern Illinois. That includes Pontiac, Morris, Ottawa, and parts of Rockford. That's where he knocked off another Republican, Don Manzullo, in 2012 to stay in Congress. Scott Schroffnagel is a professor and chair of the political science department at Northern Illinois University. He says Kinzinger proved himself an effective campaigner.
Since then, he's kind of had it easy because the Democrats in the state of Illinois, you know, drew him a pretty safe district.
Sarah Dady says the 16th district doesn't see a lot of Kinzinger these days. She says she only got one debate with him on the radio, not in front of a public crowd. She says she was only in the same room with Kinzinger three times throughout the whole campaign.
Running against Kinzinger is kind of like running against a ghost, you know.
Kinzinger's political future is wide open. On paper, he's an attractive candidate for higher office. He's 41 years old, a veteran, famously helped save a woman's life in Wisconsin by disarming a guy with a knife. And he's seen as a thoughtful Republican who knows how to campaign. He's got $1.2 million in his campaign fund as of March. State Senator Jason Barrickman is a Bloomington Republican, himself with a growing profile statewide. Barrickman says he'd like to see Kinzinger run against Illinois' senior Democratic Senator, Dick Durbin, in 2020. Barrickman says Republicans need a Tier 1 candidate to give it a shot, even if they come up short and need to try again against Senator Tammy Duckworth in 2022.
And he's getting a lot of attention in the Chicago media. He's considered to be a thoughtful Republican who is does a great job with the media. He does a great job raising money. I think Adams should be certainly one that takes a look at that.
In April, Kinzinger's name was floated as a possible nominee to become Secretary of the Air Force. Kinzinger said he'd consider it if he was offered the job. Ultimately, the Trump administration instead chose Barbara Barrett, a former diplomat and aerospace research executive. Back in Illinois, Kinzinger concedes running for something statewide, like the U.S. Senate or for governor in 2022, would not be easy.
It's not in my mind right now. I enjoy being in the House. Let's be, you know, quite clear, Illinois is not the most Republican of states either. But, you know, if there's an opportunity that pops up and I think I'm the right fit and I think it's doable, I certainly would take a look at it.
Scott Schroffnagel from Northern Illinois University says he's been watching Kinzinger's career for years. He says he seems comfortable in Washington and could rise up the House leadership ranks there. He says Kinzinger's future in higher office may hinge on the future of the Republican Party itself.
You know, and if the Republican Party is going to embrace Donald Trump wholeheartedly and stake their, you know, short-term future on his electoral success, then Kinzinger is probably an odd man out, right? He doesn't fit that mold.
Pat Brady, the state's former GOP chair, says he hopes Kinzinger does pursue higher office one day.
Politics is a lot about timing, and then let's see what happens. But, yeah, again, I think he'd be great if he wanted to do that, but I think he's smart to just focus on what he's doing right now.
One thing that Kinzinger can take off his to-do list, getting engaged. He recently got engaged to Sophia Boza-Holman, the director of strategic media for Vice President Mike Pence. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see more politics coverage at our website, WGLT.org. Just click on Politics and Government on the drop-down menu.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropist of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
The Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council has picked the economic development manager from the Chicago suburb of Tinley Park to head the EDC. In a news release today, the EDC announced that Patrick Hoban replaces Kyle Hamm, who left more than a year ago. Hoban went to Milligan University in Decatur. He spent time as a commercial real estate developer with the Decatur EDC and with the city of Decatur. He is now with the village of Tinley Park. Hoban says Bloomington Normal is an economic developer's dream.
It's centrally located. It's got some great companies there. From reading what's going on with Bloomington and be an advantage. There's a lot of volunteers standing ready at the helm to assist, but also just the schools. I mean, economic development is turning into a battle for workforce, and you've got a great talent pool there.
How do the roles differ between the EDC, the economic development departments in Bloomington and Normal, and other kinds of economic development efforts that things like bodies like the Chamber of Commerce engage in? How do you keep everybody coordinated?
That is key. Coordination is key. It's something that we've been very successful up here in Tinley Park and in Decatur. It's all about communication. So it's finding out what everyone's strengths are, what they have time to do, what their priorities are, and just hitting really the ground running as a team. So it's going to take a lot of relationship building in the beginning, but I'm confident that we're going to do that. But everyone has their own roles, and it's just defining those roles, finding out what the goals are going to be, and then really having some solid measurables in order to accomplish those goals. So I'm looking forward to working with all the community partners down there.
Part of the reason that the hiring process that has resulted in your coming on board has taken more than a year is that the EDC was in the middle of this redefinition of what it wanted to do and what it is. Can you articulate how you think that differs from what other EDCs engage in and your vision that of what they're looking for?
Sure. From my brief experience during the interview process, seeing what the EDC was in the past, I actually do know who Marty Vangus is. He's been a colleague of mine over the years. Compared to what it is now and then where it's wanting to go, I think that the best thing that we can do is just focus on best practices. I'm a big fan of studying tactics of what's been successful in other communities and implementing it here. With the change in workforce and educational needs that are going on, it's something that has to be fluid, so it's not the same as it was 10 years ago. But that's why we just have to study best practices and work together to find out, you know, what it's going to take to accomplish our goals. So that will be a very fluid process, but it comes back to the communication.
Mayor Chris Koos of Normal recently remarked during a public television forum that the region has been missing a bet and has never really done what it could to leverage the individual strengths among the mid-sized cities along the I-74 corridor, Peoria, Bloomington, Normal, a little bit in Decatur to the south, and Champaign-Urbana, that each of those communities has its strengths but has too often competed and not cooperated. How would you live out that critique in your new role?
Yeah, that's a great question. And regional economic development is the way to go. I do have contacts in all those communities since I was born and raised in Decatur. I plan on meeting with every single one of them and trying to figure out how we can put together a regional marketing approach. So the goal would be to market regionally and then sell locally. we're really not in competition with each other. It's not Champaign versus Bloomington Normal. It's really us against Chicago and us against Texas. Whenever site selectors are looking, they don't really care if it's between the two cities. They want to know, can we support the staff? If we look at the inflow and outflow of where people work and where they live, it's all over Central Illinois. So we really need to work together, and I look forward to partnering with those other communities to accomplish that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Patrick Hoban, the new Bloomington Normal EDC director, picked to replace Kyle Hamm. It's not so easy to generate cooperation, though, even if there's a recognition that it needs to happen. There was a recent campaign by the Decatur EDC to point out that crime rates in Decatur and average wages in Decatur are favorable compared to some neighboring communities, and this raised some eyebrows up here and in Champaign-Urbana and in Springfield. So is that sort of competitive, we're better than you are, public relations campaign helpful?
In my opinion, I do know those that were in charge of that campaign, and I think their goal was to really boost morale within the city. They did not, you know, look forward enough to see the unintended consequences of what it could do with the relationships around with the partners in the region. So I understand what they're trying to do, but yeah, that's not the best practice. But I still, you know, you have to overlook that when it comes to being partners. And that's one of the things that I learned in my degree at Milliken was organizational leadership. Everyone has a different style. We're going to hopefully move past that and then get everyone on the same page.
Describe your leadership style.
My leadership style is basically knowing that, you know, I do not know everything and that more minds are better than one. I really like to get a team together that has different personality types than even my own, just so we can really focus on our strengths. I mean, I have plenty of weaknesses, so I need to hire experts that can take care of those for us. And like I said, it's all about partnership and hiring the best of the best. I want to put together a really quality team that can take Bloomington Normal to the next level.
What are the pieces currently lacking in that team, given the fact that they've been without a permanent CEO for more than a year now?
Well, I believe the staff now, there's only two of us there, then myself will be added, but I really want to get a business retention expansion specialist going. I need someone to get the temperature of the community. I will be attending those meetings in the beginning, especially with the larger employers, but finding out what the needs are of our businesses. Really would be nice to find out who the suppliers and buyers are so we can have some targets to go after, working on an attraction side of things. But I also think something that we could work on together with, I believe, Illinois Wesleyan has a SBDC, is really focusing on the entrepreneurship and innovation side of things. So there's a variety of different ways that we can do economic development, but until I get around and speak with the stakeholders, figure out who's doing what, I'm not going to know who we really need to have on staff. But once we do, we'll hire the right people to do so.
There's been some talk that the EDC moving forward should be more funded through business contributions and less through government contributions. What is your view of the proper mix?
I am a firm believer in that. I do agree with that statement that most EDCs, when you look at the mix, it's probably more of a 60-40, 80-20, heavier on the private side of things. And to do that, we just really need to show our businesses what the return on investment is going to be. I mean, that's with the public as well. But there's enough businesses there, and hopefully with the new businesses that we bring in, we can show them what the return will be, that they're going to support the EDC and our efforts moving forward. But it's going to come down to, back again, going to those analytical approach, showing everyone what the return on investment is.
How does Central Illinois compete with Texas, where down in Richardson and that North Dallas corridor, they're adding, you know, 400 jobs a day, and the opportunities collect a workforce that is made to fill those opportunities, and it's tougher to keep people in Central Illinois because of that. How do you compete with that?
I agree. Another great question. It is going to be a challenge, but Illinois has its own strengths. I mean, we've got some of the best land in the world when it comes to agriculture, and we already have businesses that are existing. Rivian is a very, very exciting opportunity. I'm looking to spin off of that. But it's really basically trying to focus on what clusters you have in order to strengthen those, but also to diversify, to bring in other businesses as well. So it's really, we have to take a look at what talent we have, especially when it comes to the universities that are there, and how we can recruit in businesses that could use that talent. Because the talent's there, and then it goes away. We need to try to keep them intact. So it's really going to be a battle for talent. And I understand that Texas and anywhere in the Sun Belt is going gangbusters right now based on their the tax situation that's down in Texas and the rest of the areas compared to Illinois. But we are moving forward. Over my experience here in Illinois doing this, the biggest challenge in the past has always been the uncertainty. But as long as there can be a plan moving forward, I think we're going to be able to compete. And if you actually look at projects being done for the past 5-6 years, Illinois has ranked pretty high in actual investment. So we can compete with Texas. There's an article, I believe it's called The Governor's Cup, in Site Selection Magazine that comes out every year, and Illinois is always ranked pretty high.
Patrick Hoban starts as head of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council August 1st. He currently works for the Village of Tinley Park.
Support for GLT comes from CEFCU, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, CEFCU even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at CEFCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Bluegrass and Brass Music Festival. Coming up this weekend, John Norton will have more for us. Art and Nature meet up at the Inside Out Arts Fair coming up next weekend. This day-long event offers opportunities to acquire art as well as a chance to become a better artist yourself. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Inside Out Accessible Art Cooperative teams up with the Sugar Grove Nature Center at Funk's Grove for the Inside Out Arts Fair coming up Saturday, July 20th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event has free admission and activities. Teresa Chambers from the Art Cooperative is one of the organizers of the festival, and she says Sugar Grove Nature Center is a great location for the event because it offers so much inspiration.
We have a lot of artists that like to go out there and do what's called plein air painting, which is where you paint outdoors. And we do have several plein air artists that are coming that day, and we're going to have a little show at the end of the day. We partnered with Sugar Grove because they were wanting to have an art show at their facility. And so that turned into, okay, well, how can we get people to come out? And we want to have stuff for kids to do. And they have Imagination Grove. And so we added some other art activities like... we have alcohol tiles, we have clay creatures, we have a drum circle, we have recycled art.
So this isn't just visual art. There's music as well.
Yeah, there's music. We also have live music that will be happening. The Irish Music Jam is in the morning. And then we also have Bob Hogart, or Old Hippie Bob, as he likes to be called. He's going to be one of our morning performers. And then the Rhythm Circle will be in Imagination Grove, and it's really fun to hear the drums in the distance.
Are you focusing exclusively on local artists with this?
We have opened it up to artists that are within, you know, an area where they want to drive. We have several artists this year who are not currently members of our cooperative, which is kind of expanding. Last year we had 3, and this year I think we have 7 or 8. So we're reaching more people. We have 4 youth artists who are 18 and under that will have artwork for sale. So that's exciting. It's not very often that youth get an opportunity to sell their art without having to pay a huge booth fee. What we ask our artists to do who are selling is we ask them to donate 10% of their sales to the Nature Center, because that's how the Nature Center helps to keep their programming going. And so this is really a service project for our cooperative as an art gallery and cooperative, so that we can reach more people through art, we can have fun through hands-on art, and enjoy it in nature. The Illinois Valley Blacksmith Association has a building there, and they have a forge, and they make and sell their own tools there. And we are very excited that they're going to be there on the day of our arts fair. Last year, one of their members grows sweet corn in his garden or in a field near his house, and they brought a bunch of sweet corn, like a carful, and they cooked it, and then they gave it away to everybody. And everybody had sweet corn. It was great.
You're going to be having a photo walk. Tell me about that.
Two of our artists are photographers. I'm a photographer too, but since I'm coordinating, I can't do everything. Santino and Mike Fitchhorn have agreed to do photo walks, and what they ask is people can bring their cell phones, or you can bring your point-and-shoot camera, or if you have a digital camera, you can bring that, and they'll walk around on the Nature Center grounds out in the trails, and They'll help give you ideas on what's a good angle, what's the lighting, basically give you ideas of, now here's a great shot, but think about it from this perspective. That's the kind of thing that sometimes you just got to have the right inspiration and the little nudges to take pictures from different angles.
You'll be doing a lot of kid stuff, including giant bubbles. Now, are these like actual bubbles or are they like big hamster balls?
No, they're real bubbles. There's a special recipe that you can look up on Google, and it tells you how to make these special giant bubbles, and I believe glycerin is the magic ingredient. And so they're, you know, super non-toxic and safe for everybody to play with.
What other children's activities do you have planned?
Holy cow, there's a lot. We have spray painting with Famous Doug. He likes to do spray paint art, and it's amazing. We have wire sculpture. We have classes that will be in the classroom. They're limited to 20 participants, but they're changing every hour.
Do you have to be signed up in advance for that, or can you do that when you go to the festival?
You can do it when you go to the festival. It's just whoever walks through the door, the first 20 get to do it. But we have lots of activities right outside of where the classroom is. There's going to be clay creatures, and we're also going to have a mark and stamping activity. We have fairy houses in where Imagination Grove is. We have free face painting in the morning from the zoo crew. We have henna that's going to be happening all day for the adults and older kids. It's sometimes hard for the 2 and 3-year-olds to sit still and not touch the henna because it has to dry. We are hoping to have Kindness Rocks, a Kindness Rock station. The Mandalorian Mercs will be walking around and meeting and greeting.
Now, those are people who are involved with, basically, they're Star Wars geeks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they like to dress up in Star Wars gear and garb, and they're just going to be meandering and be available for photos. And we told them they had to leave their weapons in the car, so we're just going to be a family-friendly event.
So how does this particular arts fair support the mission here at Inside Out?
Inside Out Cooperative, we have a threefold mission. The first one is to support art and artists, local art and artists, and we're doing that by allowing the artists to sell their work. And the second part of our mission is art education, which we're touching on several ways, with hands-on art activities, art experiences during the event. And we also are going to be promoting our upcoming art classes here in our classroom this fall. And then the third one is service through the arts. And this is a huge service activity for us because we're reaching out to new artists. We have artists who have never shown their work before that will have art for sale. And we're really excited about that. We also have just new artists that we haven't made contact with that are local. And they have Etsy shops, and we've never heard of them. So that's part of it, is just getting these artists that are out there and getting them out so that everybody can meet them.
Well, who are some of these artists that we're going to meet for the first time?
We have Sean Kennel with Recycled Messages. She does collage and paper crafting. Joe Ramholtz is a wood carver, and he also does storytelling. He makes these really cool spoons that you can sample your food with, and they're old-fashioned spoons, so when your soup that you're cooking, you stir it and you take a little spoonful, well, you can turn the spoon around, and then you can cool it off while it travels the length of the spoon so you don't burn your mouth. And so he
very clever.
Really cool stories about the spoons, and he carves little faces and pencils, and he's just really great. We're so glad he's going to be here. We have Bill Crable with photography. Jody Anand does mixed media. Anki Schwiers is doing paintings, and she's one of our youth participants. Nanette Tanner has Navajo fine art and silversmithing. So there's a range of everything.
What is your ultimate goal for this event? Is there a particular monetary goal or something that's less tangible?
Less tangible would probably be the answer, because there is no charge to come. There's no charge to park. We offer a shuttle from the parking area to come to the main Nature Center building. We do ask that you bring money to support our food vendor, who is a non-for-profit. The American Heritage Girls, which is a local group in town, is going to be providing pulled pork sandwiches through Hy-Vee for sale, and chips and drinks. We have a great vendor that we're supporting financially that way. We have artists for tips. You can buy the art for sale. And so we'll have a couple donation stations around for all of the art activities, but really it's not required for you to make a donation. It's more just to cover the cost of the equipment.
And this is a great event for the whole family.
Yes. That was one of the remarks that we had last year from participants, was that we had, you know, babies that were 10 months old and standing who were just barely able to hold a brush and put the paint on the canvases that we had, all the way up to kids with special needs, kids with autism, who can come and be out in nature and not have that overstimulation of being in a building. And so they get the experience of nature, and it's less threatening. and it's calming, and we have retired people who come out and they haven't maybe painted in 20 years, or they're retired teacher. We have several of our members are retired teachers, so it's kind of fun for them to keep doing what they do.
That's Teresa Chambers from Inside Out Accessible Art Cooperative. The Inside Out Arts Fair is Saturday, July 20th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Sugar Grove Nature Center at Funk's Grove. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos from previous art fairs at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's high summer in central Illinois, but let's consider some snowmobiles, antique snowmobiles, in Hopedale, Illinois. That story comes your way in just a few minutes. Bluegrass and brass are on the same bill tomorrow at the Emmanuel Bible Foundation Summer Concert at Broadview Mansion in Normal. The Normal-based bluegrass quintet Illinois Rail opens the show at 4 p.m. Band members Clay Dixon and Cliff Anglin stop by the GLT studios to talk about that with John Norton. Anglin says Illinois Rail's first gig as a bluegrass gospel band was on a riverboat in Peoria.
I don't think everybody was interested in hearing all gospel music, but we did a lot of instrumental stuff.
You're drinking in gospel on the riverboat?
Yeah. But we played traditional bluegrass, too, that we threw together, but we'd only been together a couple weeks, so mostly we'd been working on gospel stuff.
That being said, Cliff and I have played together for 40 years. In various bands, the two of us. And we have pegged with Doug since he was 12 years old in various bands. So we've played together a long time. Dave and Peg, we just started playing with them about 13 years ago. Dave and Peg Shippert.
And that's how Illinois Rail sort of came together then?
The band came together about 12, 13 years ago. Yeah.
So does the band itself have a mission?
Share our gifts. That's really our goal, to have a good time. We're really good friends, and we enjoy ourselves, and we try to project that on stage. We're having a good time, and hopefully the crowd picks up on that. And whether they're bluegrass fans or not, they will enjoy our performance because we're enjoying it.
There has been a revival of roots music in this country over the last probably decade or so. It's really, whether it's bluegrass, Americana, other kind of roots music, whatever you want to call it. Do you have any idea what has spurred that?
Not specifically. Bluegrass music, as long as we've been in it, it has goes in waves. My opinion is that it's fun. And it's you don't have to have amplifiers. You don't have to have a bunch of stuff. You can sit around a campfire at night and play music and have a good time. That's one reason I have stayed with it. I just really enjoy it. Daddy's shed was holding on to yesterday. I think that enjoyment just spreads. Old tires, cans, trunks, and jars, and a
fork made for hay. Well, let me throw a similar idea past you. I have been programming jazz and blues music for a long, long time. And for a long, long time, there was this huge argument about what is really blues and what is really jazz, right? I mean, you had these purists who rejected bringing new elements into the genre. Is there a similar conversation that is ongoing in bluegrass as I was describing jazz
and
blues?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are pure traditionalists that don't want anything to do with, they're very indignant. It's Flatten Scruggs, Ralph Stanley, or nothing. And there are jamgrass people that are wanting to take it out to the edge. And I think those groups are what is drawing the youth more into it. Because traditional bluegrass is not everybody's taste, I'll admit. High, nasally tenor voices, not everybody can get behind that. So myself, I love the traditional bluegrass. But I do appreciate the fact that younger people are coming into it by way of artists like Sam Bush, Molly Tuttle, who's very popular right now.
Oh,
her
music
is incredible.
World Cafe the other night.
And she's bringing people into the music that same way as Sierra Hull. Mm-hmm. Her mandolin playing is amazing. More on the edge. Very capable of playing traditional music, but on the edge. And I think that draws the younger musicians in. They're attracted to that.
Gary and Cliff with Illinois Rail, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. Doug Connect, another member of your band, a heck of a banjo player. He has won, is it best banjo player in the state? Something like 8 years in a row?
Have,
am I saying that right?
Well, they have state fair. They have a banjo contest every year.
Oh, I was going to, because I wonder how you get that designation.
Yeah, every time he goes down there, he wins.
And he's won about, I think, 8 or 9 times.
No, I mean, he's only been there 8 or 9 times. So, yeah. You know.
It's a pretty good percentage of winning.
Yeah.
Gary, you're the guitarist.
I play guitar and bass. I switch off. Dave Shippert and I switch between guitar and bass.
Well, you mentioned you've been playing bluegrass and gospel, all that kind of music for decades. How did you come to music in the first place?
My mother, my mom, and my aunt and my grandpa played. They came from Kentucky, and they had a little, wouldn't have called it a bluegrass band, but my mom played guitar, my aunt played a mandolin, and my grandpa played a clawhammer banjo. So for me, the music has always been around. I never heard them play together, but my mom basically got me started on guitar, showed me chords, and got me interested.
So you basically grew up listening to music that at least had an Appalachia bass to it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I went through a period, obviously, when the Beatles hit in the 60s. That's all I wanted to listen to. My dad, when we were in the car, was listening to Clinton WHOW back in the late 50s, early 60s. Huh. He was listening to the country music, and that's what I heard, and that's what I really enjoy.
Cool. How about Cliff? How about you? You're the mandolin player. You play other instruments, too?
Yeah. In the band, I play dobro some, but I don't play them on stage much anymore because it's too hard for me to see. My vision's not real great. But we still record on dobro sometimes. But mostly play the mandolin. And then Gary and I have been doing some twin mandolin lately, so Peg can slip over on bass real easy, and Dave can play guitar when Gary and I do twin mandolin stuff.
Well, how did you come to music?
I started playing rock and roll in high school back in the late 60s. And in college, I played in a rock band. That's kind of when country rock was coming around. So I was playing in a country rock band and actually a jug band they had going in college, too.
Cliff Anglin and Gary Dixon with Illinois Rail on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You briefly mentioned that Peg was one of the songwriters in the band. Does everybody in the band write, or how does the songwriting process work for Illinois Rail?
Peg is the only one that writes lyrics.
Okay.
Now, Cliff has written some mandolin songs. Dave has written some songs for guitar, flat picking, and Doug has, for banjo, instrumentals. Yeah. But Peg is really the only one that does the lyric.
I guess you could stretch back to your other groups or whatever, but what's been the most memorable moments or the coolest gig that you guys have done? That's something that really sticks out.
Well, the coolest gig that comes to my mind right away is with Gary and I got to play with Jesse McReynolds, who's a famous mandolin player. He was playing with another band I was sitting in with down in Monticello at the Little Ryman, they call it. They were going to be able to get him and his son-in-law and granddaughter, I think, but he needed a backup band. So this other band said, yeah, they could back him up. So I got to play, and the guitar player couldn't do it. So Gary played guitar for Jesse McReynolds. And since he plays mandolin, I played dobro. One song I got a mandolin out and got to play with him without his permission. I just kind of opened it up. But anyway, that was a highlight, one of the highlights.
One of the fun things that we did in our band we played in for about 15 years, the Bluegrass Cracker Jacks, we were able to play the music for a play at Conklin Dinner Theater. That was a melodrama they put on. We did the music for a little over a year. Every Tuesday night we played that, and that was fun. Chance Conklin had seen us play one of the Brown Baggot concerts downtown, our band, and this was a year or so before he was going to produce this show, but he'd seen us, and he approached us about doing a show over there, and it's something we've never done. We don't read music. We didn't have a clue, but we went in, we had a great time. It was a long learning curve rehearsing the play, but we did a show, a dinner hour show, and then we played the music for the play, and that was fun.
Gary Dixon and Cliff Anglin of the Bloomington Normal-based bluegrass band Illinois Rail speaking with GLT's John Norton. Illinois Rail opens the Bluegrass and Brass Summer Concert tomorrow at 4 p.m. at the Emmanuel Bible Foundation at Broadview Mansion in Normal. The Twin Cities Brass Quintet plays at 5 p.m. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Russell Huck Willis has been riding snowmobiles for 4 decades now and collecting them for nearly that long. Now he's opened an antique snowmobile museum in Hopedale. Willis says the pursuit of old machines accelerated when his family became aware of the Antique Snowmobile Club of America.
But we was kind of collecting sleds on our own. We didn't know other people did that, but we was doing it, you know.
Why?
Just the passion we had, just to have something different, you know.
Some people do buttons, some people do coins, some people do sets of china. Why snowmobiles? What trips your trigger about them?
Well, I guess back in about 78, some farmers out south of town give my oldest boy a snowmobile. I never thought much about it. About 76 is the first time I ever seen one. Went past our house in the country. Then I thought, well, why would anybody want to be out there riding a snowmobile and working out in that cold? It wouldn't be for me, but once he got that sled, it just made winters fun. To put it bluntly, it just made winters more fun.
It started from one sled, and what happened?
Well, then we all got a better sled. That was our goal, to get one, you know, that you could depend on. So we rode it, or East got one and rode them. And then we started going up north with my oldest son's father-in-law. They was going up to Tomahawk, Wisconsin, and we got to doing that.
I would expect maybe a snowmobile museum in Minnesota or northern Wisconsin or northern Michigan, but Central Illinois doesn't have quite as much snow.
No, it wasn't the snow, I guess it. Of course, back when we started in the late 70s, we had a lot of snow. When we got sleds, you could just leave them out behind the house and just go riding anytime you wanted to there for 2 or 3 months, you know. Well, then when the 80s come, it just tapered off and tapered off. So then it just occasional snow, and if it snowed, you better go riding because the next day it'd be melted, you know. But we just had a passion. And it's something. It's a different world out there. You're out there. And you can just kind of tool around the timbers, you know, and see wildlife. And a lot of people think snowmobiling is just all racing and fast and dangerous, but it's not, you know. It don't have to be. Do it sensible, and it's fun.
Obviously, it makes noise. I would think the wildlife would be kind of skittish about that.
No, not really. Because I can go out on a tractor, and there'll be deer out at my house, and they'll look up at you. But they're not scared of you. Now, if you chased after them, yeah, they would go. But they're not real skittish when, you know, you're just humming along.
How often do you go out now?
Whenever we get a good snow, which is not too often. But this last winter was a little better.
How many do you have here?
We got close to 150, if not a little over.
And how old are the oldest and how new are the newest? And what are the different types?
The oldest sled I have here would be a Model T, a 1923 Model T Touring with tracks and skis on it. The newest, and then I got two Eliassons. One of them is a 1941, and the other is a 1954, or 53, can't remember which, but 53, I think.
Well, that Model T idea really did just sort of explode my idea here. I thought they didn't come in until the 60s or 70s.
Well, the Model T was made, Henry Ford didn't do it. He just made the Model T, but there was a guy by the name of Virgil White in Ossipee, New Hampshire, that he made a kit, made a second axle and skis, And in 1913, I guess they had like 40 inches of snow out there and nobody was moving anywhere. And here he come, tickety-tick, tickety-tick, across the top of the snow. So he's the one that started the Model T era of snowmobiling.
How did the different eras develop? I mean, you're obviously kind of a scholar of snowmobiles at this point, so take us through these historical periods, would you?
Well, I guess first was the Model Ts, and then everybody was trying to make a way to get around the snow, you know. And one guy that started Skidoo, which is Bombardier, he had a son that died from appendicitis because he couldn't get him to the hospital. So he's a big thing in making snow travel. Well, then there was the family of Eliassons, I guess it's called up north, but they're from Saner, Wisconsin, and he made his first snowmobile. It was a toboggan with a motor on it. It was like a Johnson outboard motor, and he used a fourth of a Model T radiator to cool it, and then he had a track down through the middle of a toboggan, and that was in 1924, his first one. And he had a club foot, he liked to go hunting, so that's kind of the reason he developed it, it's because he wanted to go hunting, you know, with his friends. Well, then he just kept making them bigger, and until about 53, then I guess their patents run out, and that's when Polaris went and copied some of their designs, and they made their first one in 54, 55. Polaris is a factory that's still going today.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Russell Huck Willis about the Snowmobile Museum in Hopedale, Illinois. They're having a Snowmobile Club of America summer meet in Hopedale this weekend, July 12th and 13th. What happened after that? I mean, now it's been motorized, gasoline motor, and now there are probably some electrics out there. What's the latest wrinkle in snowmobiles?
Well, I think they started out four-stroke engines, just like you would see on a lawnmower. Kohler was a big producer of motors, and then a few Wisconsins, few Briggs, not too many Briggs, and there was some Clintons that went on them. And then by the next big rollover was they went to two-stroke motors because they were lighter and they could produce more power. So then they started two-stroke era. And then after that, well, they went into a liquid-cooled era where they would cool them with water, like car radiator. And then they got where there's fuel injected. Then they went back to four-strokes, some of them, but it's kind of dying out again now. There's less emission in a four-stroke than a two-stroke. But now they've got them down so refined that they're outdoing the four-strokes.
So what's next, do you think?
Well, I suppose there will be a diesel, and I guess maybe they're working on battery. I've heard tell of it, but I don't know for sure.
So what's your favorite kind?
For a newer sled, it would be an Arctic or a Polaris, but for an older sled, I like some of the Arctic Cats best.
Why for the Arctic Cats?
What? Oh, I don't know. I just win more on them. When we see our Snowmobile Club of America, we have a summer meet and we have a winter meet. And in the wintertime, why, we contest them. I mean, you don't go fast, but if you beat somebody, it don't matter. If you're going 10 miles an hour or if you're going 100, you know, it's the same adrenaline pull if you're beating them.
Let's walk a little bit, and you can tell me about one or two of these things.
Okay.
So, for instance, this one looks, it's a Polaris.
It's a K95, but it's got an M on the serial number, so that meant it was military. It's somewhere or another, the government had bought it, or, you know, had it for probably Alaska or someplace.
It's fairly big, yeah. So it's meant
it's probably a medium-sized sled of that era. I got one we usually ride on a 100-mile ride. We go in 3 days. We go on a 100-mile loop in the wintertime up Knobbinway, Michigan, and a lot of fun.
So you still ride quite a bit then?
Well, I try to, yeah.
Okay. Well, I got two boys.
They go with me a lot.
What else do you want to show me here?
This here one here, that's the biggest sled Polaris ever made. That's a K24. That's got a 24-horse Kohler motor on it.
It's got a cab, actually.
Yeah, it's got a cab, and a cab probably was an accessory at one time. But it was made for pulling. That thing will pull probably 2 or 3 tons, you know.
So for supplies or what?
Oh, the farmers use them for hauling hay to the cattle out west, or They use some of them in the logging industry to get around. And mainly, I suppose, most people bought them were linemen, electric companies, when they had to go through, you know, their wires went through rough ground and couldn't get a vehicle through there. So,
how many different business applications have there been? You mentioned farming and ranching and electric linemen and the government work with supply and with the national monuments, but who else would use a snowmobile?
Well, ski hills used them. They groom ski trails with them, or, you know, they'd climb a mountain with them, them bigger ones with them. That's got like a 30-inch track, so it would, you know, pull the groomers. And I don't know, I suppose anybody that had to be out in the wilderness or whatever would use them.
Okay. So. Russell Huck Willis is a retired masonry contractor and a snowmobile collector. The Antique Snowmobile Club of America Summer Meet will be at the Willis Snowmobile Museum today and tomorrow in Hopedale, Illinois. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Laura Kennedy, Ryan Denham, and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.